Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Warbirds in Review. I'm Dan Boland. We're going to get it set up here in the shade. I want to thank the reenactors. Great job, guys. Thank you so much for coming out. Invasion from the North. The Canadians are here. How many Canadians in the audience? Raise your hands. God bless you. Thank you. Okay, we have Vintage Wings of Canada here, and they're up at Gatineau Airport, just outside of Ottawa. Sitting next to me is Rob Fleck. Welcome back, Rob.
Oh, very nice to be here, Dan.
Rob is the president of Vintage Wings of Canada, and he's brought with him today Andre Janik. Andre, vice president of maintenance, and Bob Chowderholz. Bob, he's the pilot of this beautiful swordfish. Okay, tell me about the swordfish, Rob.
To the average person, you look up and you see a gangly aircraft that only a mother could love. The reality is the aircraft was obsolete long before it went into battle in the Second World War, and it's one of the few aircraft that was operational from the commencement of hostilities in September 39 right up to the cessation of hostilities in 45. It also sunk more German U-boats than any other aircraft, this thing behind me that goes 85, 80 knots. We're going to talk a little bit more about it, and we've got some experts here. But as you look at this aircraft, just keep thinking to yourself, three brave young men, day in, day out, climbed aboard this aircraft, flew single engine out over the ocean. No heat. Of course, it's the British tradition to be cold and miserable and wet all the time. I think they love it. No heat. Most of the guys were hypothermic, couldn't feel their hands. There's often stories talking about the air observer or the navigator writing things down with pens or pencils strapped to their hands just because they couldn't close their hands around the pencil. And just as you go down that road, think of yourself on a patrol on the Murmansk run in the North Sea in this aircraft, this one-engined aircraft, and doing that day in, day out, day in, not a one-time event. Just leave that one run through your mind.
Unbelievable. Andre, it's amazing that this airplane is here. Rob told me it just flew last Tuesday for the first time. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was a pretty momentous moment for us. We've had the airplane for a number of years, but a couple of weeks ago was the first time it flew. The maintenance the effort to get it flying for that, it was we actually had to rob one of our other airplanes to get this airplane going. Luckily, it was a lot of parts were interchangeable between the other British airplanes and these airplanes. The British, I think they knew they'd have to rob all their airplanes to get the other ones going, so they made parts interchangeable. Luckily, we had another British airplane to rob. It was working on the airplane. It's basically biplane technology, you know, left over from World War I that worked really well for them, and they carried on to actually till the past the end of the war. The airplane is actually mostly fabric and tube structure, steel tube structure. There's not a lot of wood in it except for the side panels and such. The Bristol Pegasus engine 30, which has about 750 horsepower, is driving a fixed pitch propeller. For such a big engine and big airplane, to just be operating on a fixed pitch propeller is pretty actually impressive that it can that can sustain flight. But the maintenance challenges in these things are there's no parts or very little parts available. For them, we end up manufacturing a lot of parts, trading with other operators for parts, and that's a real big challenge for us, is getting parts and keeping the airplanes like this running.
It's amazing the innovation that some restorers use and ingenuity to keep these things flying. And Bob, what's it like to fly this thing? You flew it the first time last Tuesday, and you made your second landing somewhere up in, was it Menominee?
Actually, I started out in Gatineau after 30 minutes of experience with the airplane. I would describe it as a conventional flying airplane in that the controls are rudimentary, as you would expect in an airplane. It has a stick to the floor with a hoop. And I would say that it wasn't that dramatic, other than the fact that it's large and somewhat heavy. The first flight in the airplane, what I recognized right away was that you actually had to put some force on the stick to make it do what you want to do. I've flown other biplanes, taper wing, for instance, that was very responsive. And this airplane has four ailerons, as you probably noticed. So I thought it would have more active role to the position of the stick, but that wasn't actually the case. So if you wanted to turn to the right, for instance, you really had to push the stick over to the right. And as the airplane started to bank, you went to the left to stop that from continuing. Pitch control in the airplane is, I would call it mushy. So if you want to go up, you pull a control column back and you watch the nose kind of rise and you watch the airspeed immediately diminish, position the stick back to neutral. The aircraft takes off at about 65 knots, climbs at 70 and cruises at 85. So you really have a narrow range of airspeed that you're managing. And it will go south on you fast if you're not watching what's going on. Most airplane is pilots that are here would understand you use the nose of the airplane on the horizon to determine whether you're climbing or descending. This airplane has so much cowl in front of you that, in fact, that's hard to find a reference point. And I don't know if you notice up there, but there are some bars that are green that run across, have light bulbs on them. They were designed for targeting a boat. And each light bulb is 5 knots of speed. From what I read, apparently, the pilots could determine by the wake of the ship in the water how fast it was going. So they would determine 5, 10, 15, or 20 knots. And as the swordfish was going straight ahead, as the boat touched, say, the 15-knot light bulb, that was time to drop the torpedo. My imagination was running wild as I flew the airplane. Never considered myself wanting to be in the position of harm's way. And I think about those people that are in there going 90 knots with a 1,600-pound torpedo underneath you. And the torpedo aimer actually lies underneath. I don't know if you can see a little glass panel there, but he would actually lay on top of the torpedo. And the pilot's job was to descend at an accurate speed, and I believe it was 90 knots with just the right angle to release the bomb or the torpedo. If you're too steep, the torpedo would go straight into the water, into the bottom. Or if you're too shallow, it would skip. And so it was a lost shot. I was just mesmerized by the thoughts of what they were doing. Now, by the way, you have to get within 1,000 yards of the ship to target correctly. If you're too far away, the torpedo misses. If you're too close, it misses. So 1,000 yards, well, that's 3,000 feet in my books, and they're shooting at you. That's probably your pretty good target at that point. Once the torpedo is released, of course, you'd have to bank away left or right. Well, now you're a large target. I was just, like, amazed thinking that they put themselves in that position.